Because we were in that tunnel vision, we should have asked for help before, whether it's organizations like the one you run or Honey Cooperative Development. We should have stopped at some point and say, look, let's form a cooperative of six, seven people, maybe stop trading for a couple of weeks, reorganize, and go ahead with new energy. But because the bills came in, they kept coming in, you have to pay the rent, you have to keep your customers happy, we kind of never did it. But we still loved it. We learned a lot. Now, thinking about it, we could have done things different, which would mean that besides loving it, we might have been in a better position now. We'll hopefully won't be making the same mistakes in our new ventures.
Today's guest is Ignacio Gomez, commonly known as Nacho. Nacho is one of the core members and the head chef of the worker cooperative Black Cat Cafe in Hackney, East London. In its current formation, the Black Cat Cafe has served delicious vegan food for over 10 years. It is a landmark in the vegan, the cooperative, and the activist scenes and has over 1,000 reviews online with almost a perfect 5-star rating. Black Cat Cafe's future is currently hanging in the balance, though, as its two core members, Nacho and Carla, have decided to return to Europe. This poses an existential threat to the cooperative, which has been trying to recruit new members and raise money to fund the transition. And we'll be hearing more about that from Nacho now. So, Nacho, welcome to Punchcard.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming. Working in a workers' co-op and a forward-facing workers' cooperative like a cafe, you must get asked what a worker cooperative is.
Very, very often. A couple of people question us, why, what the hell are you, communists or something like that? But mostly it's people who really don't know what it means.
So when people ask you what a worker cooperative is, what how do you respond?
Like, I just give the example of what Black Cat was, like a group of people who run the place together. They take the decisions together horizontally. Every people part of the co-op has one vote. We kind of always try to get consensus in decision making and stuff. People who join as a workers, they can opt to take part of the co-op once they spend, like, I think it was around 8 months with us, and then they have the chance to join.
Cool. And yeah, so you grew up in Santiago de Compostela, which is in the northwest of Spain, in the region known as Galicia. And there's obviously a very proud tradition of kind of Galician independence. Did that have an impact on kind of your early politics?
It does, because there is very left-wing orientated, it's anti-fascist, not like conservative, like it can be, for example, in Catalonia or the Basque Country. I started going to protests, all kind of things linked to that movement.
What age did you start going to protests?
Around 15, 16 years old.
And you mentioned that you kind of got involved with the pirate radio. Was that through the protests that you were part of then?
And also, I was also active in the punk and hardcore scene. I was doing shows, going to shows, doing DJ sessions, and I always loved music. So we had this opportunity to start programming a radio station. At the beginning, it was only because we wanted to do that program for music, about music and all and that. But then we got involved in the running of the station as well.
It was run as a cooperative.
Apart from doing our program, we were doing basically like a proper news and stuff. Like, we would go to protests, records people speaking.
And it was hyper local, wasn't it? You didn't do
It
like
was
national stuff. It was more.
more in focus in the city.
And then you mentioned as well that kind of while you were at university, you did some union organizing as well.
Also linked to all this movement, we were having, there was a massive left-wing kind of independentist students unions and stuff, and I was part of it. That's where I started to learn about positive discrimination, all these kind of things, like all the, it was basically, sounds corny, but it was my school of politics, basically.
No, I don't think that's corny at all. I mean, we all got to learn it somewhere. I mean, I learned in a housing co-op. You learn in your student union and a pirate radio. I mean, it's, we all get there in a different way.
That's the beauty of it, no?
Yeah, and then you decided to move to England at some point, or.
When I finished my degree, thought, let me learn English, get better at it. So I got a job in Ireland first. I worked there for 9 months, and when my contract finished, I decided to move to London to try to work in restaurant, in vegan restaurants. And because I was already into cooking vegan food, I've been cooking vegan food since I was 17, something like that. I was doing, for what I told you, like gigs and stuff. So I was doing food for backstage, food for benefits. I wanted to work in a professional environment. I landed in Pogo, volunteer run vegan co-op, start cooking for paying customers, which was good for me.
And how did you find out about Pogo?
It must have been through reading in a fanzine or reading in maybe in the internet or something. Back then, Pogo was kind of like a really little bit of a mecca for vegan hardcore punk people.
Did you hear about it before you even moved to London, or?
Yeah, before, yeah.
How long had it been going before you got involved?
I think it had been going around 2 years or three.
What kind of form did that take in terms of like you were working together? Were you all kind of workers? Did you have to work a certain amount of hours in the cafe to be a member, or was it completely open? Anybody could be a member?
Yeah, it was quite open, but yeah, we basically, it was quite busy. And so we had to make sure that the people signed, there was like kind of a huge rota in the kitchen. And basically, whenever you wanted to work, you sign, and then that was your shift.
So obviously, how many people were involved?
We were at least 12 or something back then.
Okay, and that was at its like peak. It had 12 people.
Yes, and it fluctuated through the years.
Well, that was your second experience of being in a cooperative. How did it compare to the pirate radio?
This was less hands-on. It was basically you would go to your shift, work your shift with co-workers, and then there was no meetings per se, but we were quite active doing things, kind of thing. It was not very organized, but it kind of worked.
So it kind of had like a sort of activist-y, loose sort of vibe.
Something, yeah.
And from that, you found out about squatting.
Yeah. Right? So I was squatting before, because when I landed in London,
okay.
I went to live with a friend of mine from my hometown. I started working at Pogo, and then in Pogo, a lot of people were squatting. So I ended helping other people opening a house around the corner from Black Cat, from Pogo. Well, Black Cat Pogo is the same building.
Tell us a bit about squatting. Obviously, it facilitated you all to be working at Pogo because you know, you didn't have to pay an exploitative rent, and so you had so much more free time, basically.
Sadly, yeah, it was essential for us to be able to work for free and put effort into this project. So basically, squatting, how it worked, there's like a network of people who tell you there is this empty house all over London. And then what you do is you monitor if the house is going to be empty, for how long it was empty. Once you manage to get in because they forgot the lock or the door open, you stay living there. If you are lucky and the owner lives elsewhere and doesn't care about the property, you might go unnoticed and live there for ages. If they want to make you leave, they have to go through court. It's not that they can come with the police and evict you on that day, because you put a paper on there. I forgot now what the...
You might call it like a notice, right? Maybe?
Exactly, yeah. And then from there, you put all your effort into cleaning it. You get the electricity going, you get the water going. Some of the houses we lived in, it was luxury almost. Like, it was very clean, very like... even better than some of the houses I lived paying rent for at the some point. Yeah, there's a huge network of people that, let's say, you need someone to carry your thing from one house to another. You call this person. You don't know anything about plumbing. There is this guy who knows about plumbing, and maybe you cook dinner for them. So there's like a very beautiful movement in which the skill sharing, like we were running things in a very nice way, like sharing with people our knowledge and helping people opening houses, even if you were not going to live with it in there. So, yeah. That was a time, yeah.
And how long on average were you kind of in these houses?
Behind in the Clapton Square, we were almost 9 months.
What was the shortest one?
I think maybe 1 month or something.
And then, yeah, I mean, obviously, the law changed around 2015, and it made squatting, well, criminalized it and got rid of, I guess, the notice period. It made it criminal to squat in residential properties.
Exactly, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, during that time, I mean, how did that affect you?
I think it affected Pogo Cafe massively, because now the people volunteering there, me being one of them, had to start looking for jobs to pay bills. I went from doing 5 shifts a week and spending probably the other days just thinking about what to cook and what to do next to get things better, to have the pressure of paying rent. I started working in the city center, so I had to commute there, came back home tired. So yeah, it removed the energy out of the equation for me. I still worked there, but yeah, slowly, slowly declined till they had to close.
I mean, I was part of a similar-ish project called Rainbow Junction up in Leeds. And I mean, I think there's an interesting parallel where, look, there were lots of students who could get involved. And, you know, here in the UK, students can get maintenance loans, which, you know, essentially allowed them to pay their rent without having a job. And that gives them a lot of time, you know, which they're kind of supposed to use for study and extracurricular stuff and whatever. But, you know, some of them decided they wanted to put that time into helping this cafe to function. And without them, you know, this community cafe probably wouldn't have existed to the level that it did. And obviously squatting facilitated Pogo Cafe.
Totally,
So after kind of Pogo started to wind down because squatting started to suffocate that free labor that it had, you had to start renting. How did you end up paying for that? I mean, you got a job, presumably.
One of the first jobs I got with these kind of connections I made in the punk hardcore squatting scene, it was I got a job in a place a lot of people I know from that scene work, which was called Beetroot. It was like a vegetarian buffet in Soho. They were paying me cash in hand. I didn't have a bank account then. I didn't have anything, mostly washing up dishes and then doing a little bit of prep. From there, they were looking for a chef in a place called Gallery Cafe. I went there for a trial and I got hired. And then I stayed there working as a chef. And then eventually they offered me the position of head chef. I gladly accepted and I stayed there for around 4 or 5 years.
And how is that kind of in a traditional privately owned restaurant?
It was hard. It was because basically, yeah, the people running it, they just care about making money. Although I got along well with the Beetroot bosses, yeah, it was, you could feel that that was the only aim. Then in Gallery Cafes, because there was the component of trying to make the everything vegan, so I felt that a little bit of activism as well, and that was one of them, the highlights for me.
So if you're enjoying Punch Card, then please consider supporting us financially. I would really like this podcast to be funded by its listeners and not have to rely on advertising to keep it going. If you want to help shift the conversation away from privately owned businesses to worker-controlled alternatives, then go to our funding page, which is at opencollective.com/workerscoop/projects/punchcard. Bit of a mouthful. The link will be in the show notes. We're currently running at quite a modest budget of about 600 per episode, and Workers Co-op has funded the first three, but after that, we'll need to raise our own money to keep it going. If every listener that we've had so far gave between £1 and £15, we'd already have reached our target. Open Collective might be new to some of you listeners. It's a bit like Patreon, but it's not run by venture capitalists. So if you haven't heard of Open Collective, it is a really innovative platform, and I recommend checking it out, whether you contribute to Punch Card or not. Open Collective allows organizations and groups that don't have bank accounts, like community networks and solidarity campaigns, to manage their finances online easily and transparently. We'll jump back to London. So how did you end up starting Black Cat Cafe?
So Black Cat Cafe started because one of the members of Pogo who left at the beginning had always wanted to open her own place. So after Pogo closed, she jumped in with a group of people and took over the same building where Pogo was. It was a cooperative of five, six people, but a lot of them left really quickly because I think it was too much work for them. My friend Caroline asked me if I could come over to help, give them a hand. And that's how I started working, helping her. Eventually got busier and busier, and she got a little bit of a burnout. So she offered me to take over together with other people. That's how we took over with a.
Were you paid from the beginning?
Yeah, not very much, but yeah.
Yeah, something.
Yeah, something, yeah, which was something.
Tell me a bit about the history, because obviously, been going for 10 years, running really successfully. You know, whenever I tell anyone about it or, you know, ask people about it, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I love Black Cat, it's amazing, if they've heard of it, obviously. But yeah, how did you build that up? Did Pogo already have like a really good reputation that you were able to build on quite easily?
Not towards the end. Towards the end, it was declining a little bit because there was times that they were closed and other times there was someone cooking who was not a cook or whatever. So I feel that we have to rebuild everything. It went from being slow. I don't remember very vividly how it happened, but yeah, it basically went from being quiet to people saying, oh, I don't go to Black Cat anymore because it's always busy. I can never find a table kind of thing.
And yeah, you have no secret sauce for how you did that. It just suddenly happened.
No, I think when you have passion about something, and also we went tunnel vision a little bit as well, trying to keep serving good food, good service, trying to do benefits all the time. So we didn't have a strategy. We just did it.
So what were some of the successes that you had over the years? Some of the moments that you were maybe most proud of?
Two things. For me, it was a way exposing people to vegan food, showing that vegan food can be tasty. A lot of people coming through our doors were not vegan or vegetarian. We do it for a reason, but it's a good introduction for people to start thinking about the other issues we are fighting for. Another one is we did benefits for all sorts of things, animal rights sanctuaries, activism campaigns. For me, being vegan is much more than only food. So we achieved that by allowing people to raise funds for different causes, exposing people to political issues. So that's one of the things that makes me happy, because that's my life, basically.
Yeah, and I think something that really stands out to me about Black Cat Cafe is that it did kind of wear its politics so overtly. And to me, it kind of feels like maybe more of a European thing to be like that. It seems like all the cafes have like a political aim. And it might be that, you know, English people are just very closed off and we hide everything and, you know, very polite and we don't want to offend anyone. But yeah, no, that always stood out to me about Black Cat.
Thank you.
How did COVID affect you?
So yeah, COVID, it was a weird one because, we didn't know what was happening basically, but we had a kitchen in another place also in a pub in Old Street. So that closed first because suddenly there was no customers, there was no people around. But basically when we reopened, we relied on our regulars to grab food takeaway because we didn't want to do any Uber or Deliveroo or anything like this. We tried to set up like a group of people to do deliveries, like through an application which was developed in Paris by some bike messengers, but that didn't work because it was not busy enough.
I think that organization you're talking about is called Co-op Cycles, the French one.
Yeah, there's I think it's a co-op as well, yeah. So yeah, we survived COVID thanks to our regulars. And not having a delivery, it was in theory very bad, but we managed to survive because of the support. Also, veganism, like 8, 9 years ago, it was a bit more militant. So people would support you for being vegan and for what you fight for and for what you do for the community and everything. So most of our customers are still old school vegans who believe that veganism should be something more than food.
And I know that during your fundraising campaign recently, and I remember seeing someone on the video who was kind of talked about animal rights, and obviously that's connected to veganism. But since you've been such a central point for quite a lot of activist-y stuff within Hackney, and I imagine they're quite a dedicated sort of audience or customer base. Like, was that kind of accidentally your strategy to just like, you know, because it's kind of the giver's gain principle, right? Like you give people space, and these activists who don't have a huge amount of money, you make sure that they have a way to get food or have space to meet. And then they then reciprocate that gift by coming back after COVID and being like, this place needs us. Let's back it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that's key. Yeah, that's exactly what happened, I believe. Yeah.
What I find kind of, you know, interesting, a bit sad, frustrating, is that obviously you've put so much in, you've created this amazing cafe, but for most of the time, it was just you and Carla who were actually members of the co-op, and then everybody else was kind of workers. You maybe had some members who came for a little bit. Tell me a bit about that sort of difficulty and frustration.
Yeah, so I thought it was always very difficult to make people join the co-op. We invited through the years a few people, but yeah, for one reason or another, they ended up leaving because I don't think they were willing to make the sacrifices we needed to make to keep things running. London is very expensive, so I totally understand that if you need to pay a rent, you need to be paid for every single hour you work. And that was not the case for me and Carla because, I told you, it was like basically trying to survive on a daily basis for a long time. I wish there was more people. I'm not saying this is something negative or trying to bitch about anyone. That's the way it was. Black Cat went from 5 people to then me and Carla joining with another people who then left. And then we invited some people through the years they left. It was putting off fires constantly, basically.
I guess you kind of hinted at it a little bit there, but do you think that the main thing that put people off was that like you weren't able to kind of like make enough money to sustain people's rent and stuff? That was the main issue?
No, the people working for us were getting paid normal wages for London. We were always aiming to pay them as much as possible. But me and Carla, some of the months we weren't able to get paid, for example.
And what people saw that they saw you kind of making these sacrifices, and they were like, well, if I become a member, then I'll have to make these sacrifices. I don't want to do that. Is that what you think was happening?
That's what I think is happening, yeah.
Did you tell them that as a member, they wouldn't necessarily have to make those same sacrifices?
And some of the members joined and they were paying normally, like for every single hour they work. But then for some reason or another, they decided to leave.
Well, I mean, I think sectorally, like there's a massive amount of turnover in the industry. So, I wouldn't put it all on your shoulders. And then also, with London, I mean, London is mad. The fact that if you just get paid and you're then putting 70% of your money that you earn straight into accommodation, lots of people get sick of that and move, or, move to an industry where they make a bit more money.
Definitely, yeah.
Previously, we've spoken a little bit about reflections and learnings on things that maybe could have been done differently. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Because we were in that tunnel vision, we should have asked for help before, whether it's organizations like the one you run or Honey Cooperative Development. We should have stopped at some point and say, look, let's form a cooperative of six, seven people, maybe stop trading for a couple of weeks, reorganize, and go ahead with new energy. But because the bills came in, they kept coming in, you have to pay the rent, you have to keep your customers happy, we kind of never did it. Sometimes it's the most ridiculous thing. It's like just take one day off and go to Dalston to speak with Douglas. But sometimes you don't even have the energy to do it.
It seems to be a very typical problem. Like, it's very easy to be like, these are my immediate issues and they need to be sorted right now. It's very difficult to take a step back and be like, okay, I'm going to sacrifice one day of work so that I can go and speak to somebody who might be able to help us turn this around. And just, for people listening, Douglas is one of the kind of community developers at Hackney Co-op Development here in North London. Some of the kind of specific things that maybe would have done differently was kind of around like overstaffing, right?
I think because we got very fast, very quick, we always wanted to keep our customers happy. And how business thrive is by going through stressful situations, making your workers work very hard. We were not these kind of people. So we always hired people when, like other workers ask, oh, it's too busy. We need two people here. In order for you to thrive and make money, you might have to get that person to go through a very stressful situation. But we never did that. We always hired people. I think we ended up hiring too many people.
Did you ever have the discussion, if we hire another person, that's going to increase the wage bill and, may mean that we'll have to take a pay cut? Or you just, they said to you, we need more work. You just were like, okay, cool, we'll
We
take that.
kind of didn't question it. We just went for it.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that that was a bit of a mistake then, not talking to your colleagues and I guess workers and having those conversations about these are the sacrifices we have to make if we're going to hire more people?
Yeah, we kind of explained it because it went together with people asking for more money per hour. So there's like some things they don't simply work. If you want more workers to help you not be stressed, but then you want more money per hour. We kind of saying a few times it's impossible for us to do this, but yeah, not very often.
So did they see you as their boss, essentially?
Kind of, yeah, I think so, yeah.
So they didn't understand it being a co-op. They struggled to get their head around that bit.
Yeah.
That's tough. And I think it ties into, I think, another very typical problem is like, co-ops having to hire people who don't understand what being a co-op is and then needing to explain that and probably having to explain it multiple times because, it's quite a big cultural sort of mental shift, really, to be like, and I'm not your
Yeah.
boss, we're all in this together. Trying to do all those things at once is definitely a massive problem. I mean, this is one of the things that I hope workers.co-op will be able to help resolve is helping
Yeah.
smaller co-ops like yours to one, come and see you and be like, hey, are you guys doing okay? And two, just having better resources out there where workers.co-op will be able to help smaller co-ops to upskill their members. But
Yeah, but that's what the aim you have, and I think it's very important.
So something else you mentioned that was kind of something that you maybe wouldn't do again, which I would like to draw attention to all of these just so, maybe people don't make the same mistakes, is that you started having to pay VAT.
Yeah.
You didn't pass that on to the customers. Why did you do that?
Black Cat has been always known for cheap, big portions, quality food. And we were always trying to buy the best ingredients possible and then still keeping the things cheap. VAT came in and we didn't reflect it on the prices. We increased them slowly, slowly, but not as much as we should have.
I mean, I think a theme throughout this is just like yours and Carla's generosity and, you know, swallowing the overstaffing or, well, the kind of increased staffing costs, swallowing the VAT costs, providing base to all these activists, and the generosity that you guys have given to the community is amazing, really. It's sad to hear, you know, that you guys had to sacrifice so much to make it work.
Yeah, but I have to say we loved it. We loved it. Now thinking about it, we could have done things different, which would mean that besides loving it, we might have been in a better position now. But we still loved it. We learned a lot. We hopefully won't be making the same mistakes in our new ventures.
We'll get onto that in a sec. So two other choices that you made that I wanted to kind of just draw attention to. One, you decided not to charge service charge, even though you kind of do a little bit of table service. I guess that's not, in a cafe, that's not, it's not super traditional to have service charge, is it?
Well, these days it is, I think.
These days it is, okay.
I've been going to a place, when you go to pay, even if it's takeaway, they put you the thing to pay the tips. Yeah, we do the kind of, let's say, 90% table service. The only thing you have to do is come to us counter, but we bring you the food, and then if you want water or whatever, we bring it to you. So yeah, we never did service charge, which I think I would be transparent about it. And you know how in some places you don't even notice that it's service charge. But if I do it again, I would say, would you like to pay service charge to the customer instead of writing a little thing on the ticket?
Yeah. And then also, I mean, you decided not to sell alcohol, which I think is kind of crazy because the stereotype within the sector of restaurants and kitchens is that you make, I don't know, I can't remember what the percentage is, 60, 70% of your income comes from drinks, and specifically a lot of that being alcohol. And then, yeah, the food is just to get people through the door.
Neither me or Carla drink, and we haven't drank for the last 30 years, maybe, or something, or 20 years. And yeah, and it's not that I have anything against maybe having a beer with your meal, but a lot of people make drinking a way of living kind of thing, like they do it for the sake of it. So we knew it could make us some money, but we decided not to do it because that's what we believe. We considered towards the end to try to make a little bit more of money, but yeah, we never went for it.
No, fair enough. And I think I was slightly hyperbolizing then, because obviously you're a cafe that opens till 4, so you're probably not going to sell that much alcohol.
No, we used to open till 9 before.
You used to open till 9, okay.
Yeah.
Any other lessons you want to add on there that if somebody's looking to start a worker co-op cafe, they might want to think about?
I think plan things a little bit. Get together with a group of comrades, have a few meetings before going ahead, research what you have to do, research what kind of help there is available, and to make sure you really want to do it, because it's not going to be easy and you're going to have to sacrifice. But if you love it, you will thrive and you will make it work for sure. Like everything in life, I guess. But keep in mind that you won't be able to buy a house with a swimming pool in the outskirts of London. You will have to fight for every penny. If you are passionate about something and you put the hours, even if it's very difficult, there are room in this world to build beautiful things like what we try to do and you guys try to do. So we can do things outside of the margins of what the system is. And I think it's a beautiful thing. So try to do it.
On that point of have a bit of a plan, did you feel that at the beginning of Black Cat, it just started really quickly? You had no time to plan anything. You just had to get going from the bottom.
Exactly, yeah.
You tried to run this fundraiser. I think you were trying to raise between 70 and 90K. You weren't able to. I think you raised 5. And what you said to me before was that people said to you, if you and Carla were staying, they would have given money. But because it was for this new project, it was kind of risky, and maybe they didn't trust it. They didn't know who was getting involved. So there was a kind of fear there. You did that process for about 6 months. You were trying to find people and trying to...
I think the campaign was on for around 3-4 months.
It was 3-4 months. Okay. Through that, you did have a few people who were interested. How was that experience of getting people through the campaign, trying to get them involved and trying to get them ready to take over the cafe?
It was a good experience. This group of people, none of them had any, they couldn't put any money on the table, basically. So we had to make sure that the campaign was working in order for them to take over. We were very excited about them. They even did shifts in Black Cat, and they had a lot of potential, but it didn't go ahead because we had to cancel the campaign because it was not successful. But it was really nice to see that people are as passionate as us about this project, and they were willing to put the hours, start running it. Sadly, it didn't go ahead.
Yeah, sadly, it didn't pan out.
Yes, so we were excited about the possibility of keeping a co-op running. We did the fundraising campaign, but it didn't work. So the next best thing is a family of four people who are our customers expressed the interest of taking it over. The problem with London and the money, basically they are young. So for them, they only had one way of getting a loan, and we're still waiting for that loan because it's a very lengthy process. Now they are towards the end of it, and if things work out, that a family of four are taking over, are going to keep the same ethos, trying to run it as we were running it. For us, it's kind of a victory because it's the next best thing.
Running it with your ethos minus the co-op bit.
Hopefully that's what was going to happen, yeah.
So you're back in Santiago de Compostela. Tell me about your new project.
We are going to open a little coffee shop in my hometown, Santiago de Compostela, like a big coffee shop / bar. We are going to be opening in the evenings with serving some tapas. And then we also have a guest house 10 kilometers away from here, which we're going to be running hopefully through Airbnb, which we learned about it through you and Douglas. Which you want me to explain it? This
I can do a little bit. Airbnb is a international cooperative that started in Italy, and the idea is that it's an alternative to Airbnb. And I think if I remember correctly off the top of my head, 11% of the money made, instead of going to shareholders, goes directly into local community groups that the guests can choose when they sign up to visit. So yeah, I don't know what kind of community groups you have near you, but
we already chosen animal sanctuary, which is relocating and is working from outside our hometown. And animal sanctuaries are essential, and for me they are the heroes of the vegan movement, like, because they are constantly working, constantly having to pay bills, and yeah, they can do with any help they can get, so we'll support them through Airbnb.
But yeah, is it going to be a co-op?
No, it's going to be a limited company. We wish, or maybe in the future we do something else and another co-op at some point, but not for the moment.
Will you hire in staff then?
It's going to be a small, so it's going to be mostly me and Carla working on a daily basis, but we probably have to hire a couple of people or two people.
In some ways, that's a bit of a sad story for me. You've been doing co-ops for so long. Black Cat was so exhausting, you're burnt out, and you're now going to try something else in the kind of traditional business hierarchy sense.
Well, I'll probably try to make a living out of this traditional business, but I'll have in the back burner a few ideas to maybe they can run as a co-op.
You know, I have no doubt that you're going to run a very ethical business.
Let's see, yeah.
Well, yeah, let's see. Maybe you'll turn out to be a greedy capitalist after all.
Could be. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Punchcard is released monthly, so look out for the next episode. If you enjoyed listening, please consider supporting Punchcard by going to our Open Collective page at opencollective.com/workerscoop/projects/punchcard and starting a monthly contribution. We currently have seed funding for the first 3 episodes from workers.coop. But we will need your support to be able to keep Punchcard running after that. If you are interested in finding out more about worker cooperatives, then check out workers.coop's website. And don't be shy to send any questions you have or ask for support by emailing solidarity@workers.coop.